So then humanistic neurolinguistic psychology is the study of how mind creates reality through language and behavior.
So when we talk about just the notion of humanistic, we've always believed that NLP was really about people and their interconnectedness and really the possibilities that they create for their own transformation. So one of the things that we think about is, in fact, I had a supervisor once who I was working with. We had an interesting conversation, and we were talking about, well, what's really the purpose of these techniques in NLP? You know, when we're working with somebody, are we really just trying to bypass their conscious mind? And one of the things that we decided was that sometimes the techniques aren't really for the client's conscious mind, and sometimes they're not even for the client's unconscious mind. Sometimes they're not even for our conscious mind and our unconscious mind. They're just there to give us something to do, while something else, which is probably much greater and something that's quite unknowable, allows the change and the healing to take place. So for us, change really occurs within and among people. They're a necessary variable, at least when we're talking about humanistic neurolinguistic psychology. The techniques are really just pointers. So they give us a way to organize our conscious and our unconscious minds, but they're not really the magic. The magic is really something that really is inexplicable. When change occurs in a person or a relationship, there's always a lot more going on than what traditional science can currently measure or explain. For our field to grow, we feel like we need to think bigger. Because what's happening now is even some of the things that were very controversial in NLP when it first, during its first inception, say in the mid-70s, now science has actually caught up enough in terms of technology to be able to measure some of the things that we were talking about back then in the field and is saying, yeah, this stuff seems to be quite valid. However, what we're saying is that there's always going to be a lag there. So we're all here for a purpose, we know that, and we think that that purpose is really to actualize our true self, who we're really here, who we're here meant to be. And we figure that everybody's on the road to self-actualization, whether they know it or not. You know, some people go calmly and some people go kicking and screaming, but we're all evolving in some way. And fundamentally, we think that we really are connected at a very, very deep level. And if you doubt this, you might be surprised, because now science has actually proven that that is the case.
So then humanistic really means that we're talking about something that has to do with people, their interconnectedness, and the possibilities that they create for their own self-actualization.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, when we talk about neuro, obviously that we're talking about the nervous system. But in our branch of NLP, we're really thinking about the nervous system as an instrument. And it's really an instrument through which we interpret reality, or what we represent actually as reality. So it's the instrument through which consciousness, or what some people would call spirit with a capital S, flows. The body-mind, the rest of us, all of us, on the physical plane, is really the instrument that consciousness plays. And it can only be played as precisely as the instrument is tuned. We have a friend named Bob who gave us really this lesson in this way of thinking about this. And he talked about folks who were really gifted healers. And there were some healers that were very, very effective with a very small band of problems. Like they were very good with a certain type of health problem or a certain type of psychological problem. And the way he explained that to us was that it really is a lot like a musical instrument. That even though there's this thing called energy which permeates everything, the energy as it runs through the person, who is the therapist, let's say, who is the instrument, can only work as precisely as that person's nervous system is tuned. So what that means then is that we all have, we could say, an obligation, or it's at least incumbent upon us to learn everything that we possibly can learn so that we've developed all the neurological potential that we possibly can, so when the energy goes through, it can play us much better. It would be like the difference between playing a keyboard that has one octave compared to expanding the repertoire to, say, 88 keys, and obviously the energy can do a lot more with that.
So then neurojohn, really, if we were going to summarize that, we would say neuro refers to the instrument that we are, and the instrument through which we interpret what we call reality.
Exactly. Which most people have limited to the physical nervous system up to this point.
Right.
Of course, linguistics, that's our middle name, so that's language. And language in everyday life, although it's not the only one, it's certainly one of the fundamental building blocks for creating material reality. As Deepak Chopra says, language is how we create something from nothing. So if consciousness is the creator of reality, then language is the creating of reality. And what language does is our language, once we begin to understand how we use it and how it's formed, it begins to point to the limitations that we impose upon ourselves in order to make meaning of the world. And it's a compromise that we all make so that we can communicate that meaning to others.
So then linguistics, referring to language, if we were to summarize that, then we would really say that linguistics is one of the building blocks for creating that reality, and it actually creates boundaries around that reality and begins to define the reality that's perceived through the nervous system.
Exactly. And we spend in the fast track, we'll spend about 3 days talking about language and working with language and actually working with how can you take a person to that place where all that exists is pure consciousness, where a person can actually have the opportunity to create something totally new simply by using language. And then we like to use the word psychology instead of programming. And there's a couple of reasons why. One of them, which is a little bit more highfalutin, is that we just think that psychology broadens the scope of possibilities, that makes NLP a lot more readily accessible to the general public. What we discovered was that many times when we would do introductory seminars over the years for NLP, particularly in the area geographically where we live, the idea of programming isn't always met with fond approval, and that it brings to mind things like mind control and a lot of other principles that really are quite limiting as far as we're concerned in terms of the scope that we want to work with people. Our feeling is that people are a lot more dynamic and they're not really machines waiting to be programmed. And with all due respect to the founders, I mean, you have to look at this from a historical point of view. The word programming came about in the mid-70s when the computer industry was really just taking off, and John and Richard, even geographically, were right in the middle of that. And of course, Richard's background was information processing. Since our background is more psychology in the first place, it just feels more comfortable for us to open the lens, if you will, or open the aperture of the lens to invite other kinds of information in.
So psychology is really the study of people, their psyche, their mind, and that refers directly back to humanistic neurolinguistic psychology, which is really the study of how people's minds create their reality through their language and their behavior.
So what we'd like to do is actually take a few moments and talk a little bit about some of the basic presuppositions of humanistic neurolinguistic psychology. We should tell you this isn't all of them, but these are three of the more interesting ones that could certainly whet your appetite to possibilities beyond traditional psychology as we know it.
So the first one is, and we love this one, this is one of our favorite ones, if and when you come to one of our trainings, you'll probably hear this a lot. And for me, it's personally been a great resource in my life. And that one is, no matter what you think you are always more than that.
One of the things to consider with that is that's just a great thing to meditate on right there. And they're just, even based on the language itself, it's something called an inductive language pattern that we'll talk about later on in the training. But just consider that, no matter what you think you are, no matter how expansive you think that is, you're always more than that.
So in many ways, we believe that this is probably the single most important presupposition that we have in humanistic NLP. It's not only important to believe this about ourselves, but really it's important to believe it about our clients too. And it's easy to think that all we are is what we think we are. Because in traditional NLP, we explain that everyone has a conscious mind and an unconscious mind. And the conscious mind is that small band of information to which we are aware at any given moment. It's really an established fact that we can only hold 7 plus or minus 2 chunks of information in our awareness at any one time. Yet the rest of us, our unconscious, is receiving about an estimated 2.3 billion bits of information per second. So our conscious mind is really like a laser beam in a dimly lit room. It only lights the area where we shine it. And our unconscious mind is the rest of the room. So thinking that we are only our conscious mind would be like saying that the rest of the room really doesn't exist. And we know that that's not possible. So we really are more than just our conscious minds, so much more than we could ever consciously realize. Now, most people actually credit Erickson, Milton Erickson, with the NLP presupposition, we have all the resources that we need to change. And Erickson strongly believed that our unconscious was a storehouse of resources, memories, experiential learnings, as well as the seat of our emotions and all of our automatic functionings, like our breathing, digestion, the regulation of all of our other vital functions. And while we agree with this, we're actually proposing that we are even more than this. We are more than our unconscious mind. So just think about that. First, we say you're more than your conscious mind. Now we're saying you're even more than your unconscious mind, even more than everything you're not aware of. And consider the often quoted research that you've probably heard about at your practitioner training of a fine gentleman by the name of Wilder Penfield, who was a neurosurgeon, I believe. And he's the Canadian neuroscientist that NLP trainers actually love to quote to substantiate the archival model of the brain. And that's basically that everything we've ever experienced is actually stored as a memory. And he found that when he would electrically stimulate a specific point on a patient's cerebral cortex, that the patient would actually begin to relive a memory. And Penfield, in his research many years ago, was actually looking for what they were calling then the engram. That's E-N-G-R-A-M. And that was actually what they thought was a memory trace. This was the idea that each memory has actually a specific location in the brain. And so Penfield, as he would touch different areas of the brain, the patient would experience different memories in quite vivid detail. And after he repeated this procedure with numerous patients, he formed a number of conclusions, and three of those are relevant to what we're talking about here. One of those was actually wrong, one was plausible but virtually impossible to prove, and the other was beyond anything that science could actually handle.
So the first conclusion was that each memory had a specific location, and most of our current research now suggests that this isn't really the case. The brain seems to be organized more along functional lines rather than site-specific lines, so the idea of holography. You probably just know yourself that memories can be found, you know, in the body, maybe because of an injury or any kind of trauma, as well as other things. So memories really appear to be more of a product of networks of biochemical waves that resonate throughout the mind-body, not specific sites. The second conclusion was that everything we've ever experienced is in one way or another recorded in our brains. And this is the one that most of us in NLP use in our introductory seminars to really open people's ideas up. Now, while this is a useful belief to have, it's a darn hard one to prove, because how could we ever take an electrical probe and touch every, you know, millimeter of a person's cerebral cortex to and then be able to verify that every memory was actually in there? It was more of a leap of faith that Penfield was willing to make, simply because when he used the probe, people would just actually experience memories that were such a tiny slice of life that he figured that everything else must be there. So really, even though it's a useful belief, as I said, it's pretty darn hard to prove, and in most cases it'd be probably easier to disprove. The third conclusion is the least well known and perhaps the most significant, and something that while Penfield really had discovered it fairly early on in his research, which would have been, say, in the 1930s, was something that he really didn't want to make public until much later in his memoirs, which would have been in the 70s. And that is that we're more than our memories, we're more than our brain, and we're even more than our body. Because during the experiments, what Penfield would do is he would ask patients about their memories. And what they would do is they would describe the experience in full V-A-K-O-G detail. And while they were experiencing the memory, they'd also have a simultaneous awareness of being somewhere else, like in the operating room at that point in time. Now here's the twister. Penfield would ask them if they were fully in the memory, if they could be fully in the memory, or if they were fully in the operating room. And what they found was that they could easily shift between those two different memories or experiences, if you will. When he asked them who was doing this, was it the person in the operating room or was it the one in the memory, they answered that it was neither. It was what some people call the choice maker. In other words, they experienced themselves as a witness or an observer or a consciousness, if you will, that actually operates through pure intention. So in other words, someone else was playing the instrument. It was literally like they were this amorphous kind of energy that was not in any way limited by their body at that moment in time. So we'd like you to consider the following. You have a body, but you are not your body. You are more than your body. You have emotions, but you are not your emotions. You are more than your emotions. You have a conscious mind, but you are not just your conscious mind. You are more than your conscious mind. Of course, you have an unconscious mind, but you are not your unconscious mind. You are more than your unconscious mind. In fact, you have thoughts, but you are not just your thoughts. You're even more than your thoughts. In fact, no matter what you think you are, you're always, always more than that.
So the second presupposition of humanistic neurolinguistic psychology is that reality is a construction. And this really gets to the heart of the matter, no pun intended, of course, because it all started around the turn of the 20th century when the field of physics, that was actually Newtonian physics, thought that it had explained just about everything. And Newtonian physics was based upon the premise that everything, which reality is part of everything, could be reduced to little tiny small particles called atoms, which had protons, neutrons, neutrons, and electrons. And you probably remember that from your days in science classes, the electrons went around the nucleus and all that type of thing that you learned when you were in elementary school. And these were the basic building blocks of reality. Newtonian physics was logical, linear, organized, and things worked very well within this framework. The model created a foundation for all modern science, including medicine and psychology. 100 years ago, the only two things which they had not fully explained, that if they would explain it, would cause physics to actually become a closed science, was, of all things, gravity and light. And when they studied light, the neat and tidy little world of Newtonian physics was actually rocketed into hyperspace because there was a very big problem. When physicists studied light in its most elementary form called photons, they discovered that light sometimes behaved as a particle, which is what they expected, and sometimes it behaved as a wave. So it was actually the same light, sometimes behaved as a particle, and sometimes it behaved as a wave. And then to make matters worse, while an electron sometimes behaved as an object, they discovered that while it was at times an object, it also had no dimension, meaning, of course, that it had no mass. So whether the electron was a wave or a particle all depended upon the context in which it was observed and how it was observed. So in other words, reality at the deepest level is observer-created. Quantum physics has actually dissolved the difference between field and matter, or for our purposes, thought and matter. Thought and matter, field and matter, are one in the same. So the quantum field is unlimited potentiality. It's pure information and pure creativity. It has no form as we know it. It only exists as probabilities. And the quantum field is referred to in many spiritual systems. You may be familiar with it being called the void in Buddhism, or the Akasha in Hinduism, the Io in Hawaiian. And that's just to name a few that we've actually studied. Basically, it is everything that is, was, and will be simultaneously.
Think about that.
In other words, it is beyond time, beyond space, beyond matter, and beyond energy. Just think if you could learn to fully tap into this, and you can. There are systematic ways to do this, and they're actually easier than you might think. In fact, we'll be covering many of these ways at your Master Practitioner Fast Track Training.
So if reality is a construction, or reality at the deepest level is observer created, then how does creation occur? Well, physicists say that what turns the quantum field into matter is measurement. So measurements in human terms is really our observation. In fact, the words matter and measurement come from the same Greek root, metra, which actually meant uterus. So thought gives birth, as it were, to matter through measurement. Our thoughts behave like waveforms until we identify with them. So we put energy into them. Before we have thoughts, all that exists is pure potentiality. Nothingness and allness occurring simultaneously. Once we have a thought and we put it into language, and language, by the way, could be symbols, it could be sounds, or it could be words, what most of us think of, we're well on our way to creating a reality. And this is when we make, literally, something out of nothing. Language is how we do it. Our language then becomes, in large part, our map for reality, and it dictates how we perceive reality. Just look around you. Look around the room or wherever you happen to be right now. Everything that you can sense, wherever you are right now, started with a thought, including you. The fact that you can sense it means that sufficient energy accompanying it, and that the thought actually developed its own reality and became more and more material. So we create our own reality by first having a thought that we pull from the void, if you will, from that vast frequency domain. And then once we do that, as we put more energy into it and identify with it more and more fully, it begins to take form. And with language, language is recursive. So eventually then we lose track of the original spirit of creativity, and we begin to, as Korzybski said, mistake the map for the territory. The bottom line is we create our own reality.
So the third presupposition that we're going to be discussing here today is that everything and everyone is interconnected. If you've studied any spiritual systems, you've probably heard or read, we are all one. And many of us in NLP have believed this for a long time, yet it was really never included as one of our basic beliefs or understandings. So again, we can use quantum physics to bridge traditional NLP and spirituality. About 20 years ago, quantum physicists actually proved that reality is what they call non-local. And you might be asking yourself, well, what does that mean, non-local? It actually means that in the world beyond the quantum level, cause-effect does not exist, that actually there is no space, there is no time, and this is actually not quantum theory anymore, it's quantum fact. So quantum fact means it's something that's actually been proven. About 60 years ago, physicists observed something that was really unexplainable. They were watching two photons flying around and found that each one seemed to know what the other was doing instantaneously, that actually their movements co-varied exactly one for one. And this observation caused a real problem for physicists, because in order for them to communicate instantaneously, the information that was passing between them would have to be moving faster than the speed of light. And according to Einstein's special theory of relativity, that I'm sure you have on the tip of your tongue right now, this was actually impossible. Taking this into account, then the scientists concluded, and then they proved, that there had to be a deeper level of existence outside of our three-dimensional universe where everything is connected. And the reason why the two particles knew where the other was going was because at the deeper level, they were the same particle. They were the same holograph. It was only the scientists' observation that made them appear to be separate. We are made of the same stuff as these particles. And there is a deeper level of reality on which we are all connected. Mind, or consciousness, is not rooted in any one place. You can't go to the place where mind exists and dig it out and retrieve it. It's omnipresent. This means that we have access to all the information that there is. And it means that distance healing is possible, and that the concept itself of distance is actually a misnomer. It means that we have a lot more to do with how the world is than what the Newtonian physicists led us to believe. We can heal each other by healing ourselves, because we are all connected at the deepest level.
So then just consider, what is really beyond NLP? Well, we'll tell you this. There is certainly a lot more going on than what we know. We know that for sure. So we need to be willing to let go of our certainty long enough to find out what's really outside of our map of reality. We need to go through a period of not knowing, and Erickson talked about that term all the time, not knowing. Same with Don Juan and Carlos Castaneda, in order to get to a new level of understanding. So if we all have a map of reality, just by virtue of having that map, that then means there has to be an edge to the map, and there has to be something beyond that. As far as we're concerned, your training in humanistic neurolinguistic psychology is about finding out what is beyond that edge.